Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. Yvonne Takborian, Seville, may it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Shirley Taylor, with my co-counsel, Michael Weiss. This is a case of first impression before this Court. The issue is how to correctly interpret 19 Delaware Code, Section 2301B, B1, and B2, the average weekly wage calculations of a claimant when she's been injured, he or she has been injured in a work accident. Whether this Court finds that this particular statute is ambiguous or unambiguous, it's claimant's position that it should be resolved in the claimant's favor. The employer and the claimant agree on a multitude of items that are pertinent to the sole issue before the Court today. We agree that de novo is the appropriate standard because it's a legal issue. We agree, importantly, that the workers' compensation statute is meant to compensate employees for their lost earning capacity, not their lost income. We agree that the Workers' Comp Act shall be liberally construed and reflects public policy to compensate employees for injuries sustained during the course of their employment. Most importantly, we agree that Section 2302B and B1 apply for employees who have worked for an employer between 13 and 26 weeks. Claimant's position, however, is it's not mutually exclusive to those employees. B1 applies to employees, regardless of their length of employment, in addition to those employees that have worked there between 4 and 6 months. The Industrial Accident Board and the Court below found that the term worked less than 26 weeks under B1 was ambiguous, and it could mean one of two things. It could be the employer's interpretation, which means it applies for those employees between 4 and 6 weeks, or it could be our interpretation, which means regardless of your length of employment, if, for instance, the claimant worked somewhere for 10 years but actually physically worked less than 26 weeks and more than 13 weeks, this section would apply. We take the position that the court and the board below really made no inference that the term under B1 that talks about actually worked, when an employee actually works for an employer, whether or not that is ambiguous. We would take the position, as you read in our brief, that whether it's ambiguous or unambiguous, the court should still resolve this issue in our favor.
Do you believe this is a case of first impression, and is, just for our benefit, is it something that's, as Chancellor Allen used to say, warmly contested among workers' comp counsel?
It is. My understanding is I attended a recent workers' compensation seminar in January, and there are a bunch of board decisions that are looking at this issue. And so I know that the workers' comp bar is anticipating what this court's going to do with it, because it is going to affect either other appeals that are likely going to be brought before this court, or it's going to resolve the issue. If you look specifically at the language under B, we think the General Assembly's intent was not to separate employees that work for 0 to 13 weeks, 13 to 26, and then 26 and above. If you do it that way and that way only, employees that have longevity with an employer are going to be penalized under this employer's interpretation of what the court held below was appropriate. They didn't make Section B with a period at the end of it and then do two separate subsections. What they put is that the average weekly wage will be determined by taking the total wages paid to the employee during the 26 weeks preceding the date of injury and dividing by 26. It doesn't end there. There's then a comma and provided that language. Provided that, which we read it to be an exception, provided that an employee has to work the full, provided the employee has to work physically work in that employment between 13 and 26 weeks. I think this can be illustrated best by an example. If, for instance, you have an employee that works for you for 10 years and takes 2 weeks of unpaid vacation, they get paid $500 a week for the 10 years prior to their work injury. They take a 2-week paid vacation, and those zero earnings get calculated in that average weekly wage. The earning capacity is not going to be $500. It's going to be $461. When it's clear that the future earning capacity, which is what this court has to apply, is clearly $500, not $461. If you read it as the employer in its counterargument to that example in this brief says, well, there really is no difference between an employee that works 13 to 26 weeks and one that works 26 weeks plus, because the 13 to 26 week employee would get the benefit of the calculation the same way the 26 plus employee would get the benefit of the calculation, which means you divide by the larger number and the earning capacity is a lot less than that. We would submit that's not a fair representation of that claimant's wage, just like the claimant in this case. She had worked for this employer. She made $513 to $1,100 a week. The employer's calculation for the average weekly wage, if it's accepted, will say that her earning capacity is $485. Clearly, that is not what she's capable of earning in employment, because she can earn more than that. Our calculation would be that you divide by the 16 weeks she actually worked, which is what the statute tells you to apply. That would give you an average weekly wage of $788 per week, which is the average of those earnings. I think in the court below, they talk about how this could be a windfall for the claimant. It's not a windfall for the claimant, because the claimant isn't paid based on a $788 calculation. The claimant in workers' comp gets two-thirds of that average weekly wage. So if you look at the next 6 months, if she earned $12,000, which our claimant did here before she was hurt, and you look at the next 6 months, the argument below is made that it's a windfall because her earnings for the next 6 months would be $20,000. That's not correct. Her earnings would be two-thirds of $20,000, because it's the comp rate that a claimant receives wages on, not the average weekly wage. The comp rate would mean that she gets $13,000 in the next 6 months of wages, which is pretty equivalent to the average weekly wage that we're asking this court apply. And it's equivalent to the $12,000 that she had earned in the 6 months before she was hurt.
Let me ask you to help me work myself through this analysis.
Okay.
Take the word worked as it appears in the statute. Do we use the common dictionary definition of work? Do we look at the word worked in the context of the statutory scheme? Do we define worked in the context of what you earlier identified as the public policy behind the scheme, which is to liberally construe compensation in favor of the employee? And I ask it with work could be here either meaning time employed or time actually worked.
Correct.
Now, with those three constrictions, dictionary, statutory scheme, underlying public policy, what do we work with to come to the result that you advocate?
I think all three of them, it has to be worked, not employed, and I'll tell you why. Under Section C.
And when you say worked,
yes,
you mean time actually worked.
Time actually worked. We believe the General Assembly's intent was clear when they did B and B1, when they put together B and B1, it uses the word worked. When they do B2, they use the word if the employee sustains a compensable injury before completing the employee's first 13 weeks on the employment. They could have easily have said in B or B1 if the employee was employed less than 26 weeks. It's not what the statute says. It says if the employee worked less. And it didn't just use the word worked there. It also used it later on in the statute, divided by the total number of weeks actually worked. The lower courts below didn't find that actually worked here was ambiguous. They found what was ambiguous was the worked less than 26 weeks. The employer in its brief uses that word worked, the fact that it was found to mean employed at the first part of the statute, the second part of the statute. That's not what the legislator wrote. The legislator wrote actually worked. And we would take the position the only fair way to do this for claimants is to look at the weeks they actually worked. For example that I gave you. If an employee, I'll give you another example. If an employee goes out on FMLA, their mother is
on
sick.
What?
On FMLA. Okay.
I'm from downstate. You're talking awfully fast.
I'm sorry.
Slow down just a little bit.
Okay.
More.
If they go out on the Family Medical Leave Act, they have a sick parent and they're out of work for, let's say, 4 months. They've been an employee with my company for 20 years, and during that period of time, I've always paid them $500 per week. When they return to that employment, let's say they get hurt on their 13th week back to work, let's say even the 8th week back to work, they get injured their 8th week back. If you accept the employer's interpretation, you would take most of the zero earnings during that period of time to come up with a correct average weekly wage. I did the numbers as an example. If they got injured their 8th week back and you looked at the 26 prior weeks, the earning capacity would be $135 per week, not the $500 per week that claimant had earned in the 20 years that they had worked with the company before they went out. Surely that is not what the General Assembly intended when they wrote this statute. The statute has always been in its history to look at a claimant's earnings in the 26 weeks that they had worked before they were injured. I knew it was common practice during that 26-week period of time. If there were earnings during that 26-week, though, were not reflective of those earnings. A lot of what we did in common practice was to kick out perhaps the highest and the lowest earnings because they were not reflective of an earning capacity. I suspect that's what the legislator was doing here, maybe inartfully, but there's to look at it through the employer's interpretation would not be a fair calculation of a claimant's earning capacity, not loss of income, and that's what we're basing it on. I would also submit...
Before you get off of that, is it right that under the mode of calculation that you're arguing for, and again, let's take the employee who's been making $500 a week and been working for 20 years for the same employer, and let's assume that, during the 26 weeks or, period before the accident, there'd been no missed weeks at all, then the result should be $500 per week.
Correct.
Which I guess translates into loss of earning capacity equals the highest rate, the highest weekly wage that had been earned.
Correct.
At least during the, the preceding period.
And the way that it's always been done, we've always looked at the 26, and I say always, as long as I've been in practice and with the history of calculating a claimant's average weekly wage, you've always looked at the 26 weeks. And if they miss no time from work, whether they earned $25 a week or $1,000 per week, you add them all in, and you divide by 26. Under B1, it's telling you to do the same thing. What it's telling you is take the total wages earned, look at the amount of weeks that were actually worked by that employee and divide by that number.
But the ceiling for measuring loss of earning or future earning capacity is
yes.
What the employee is presently earning.
Correct.
Assuming no missed weeks.
Correct. That would be the ceiling. I'll stay with the ambiguous argument for just a minute more, assuming that you find that the statute is ambiguous, and I do want to address the unambiguous one as well. You have to look at what makes the most sense. You don't want an absurd result, and I will argue to you that you would have an absurd result because the only employees that would benefit from the employer's interpretation of this statute is an employee that works between 4 and 6 months. Those that work 26 weeks or more, the longevity employees, the long-term employees, are going to be penalized by this. Because if they take unpaid vacation, they're out for medical leave, if they have an ill parent that they have to take care of and they don't get wages, those are the employees that are going to be penalized. If you look at B2, B2 is a fair way to calculate somebody's earnings that's been employed for 0 to 13 weeks. If you take somebody that gets hurt on the job in their very first week, obviously you can't use B or B1. Because the idea was to have a fair calculation for employees with limited work histories. Under B2, you look at the contract that the hours were based upon. If we're going to pay you $500 per week, that's the contract that we've agreed to. You get hurt in the third week, your average weekly wage is $500 per week. If you make $2,000 a month, you divide by 12 months, same average weekly wage. The only set of employees that are penalized under this interpretation are the long-term employees who have missed some earnings during the period of time before the work accident actually occurs. I would also submit that if you find that the statute's ambiguous, the claimant's position should be upheld by this court, our interpretation of the statute. You have to look at the clear language of the statute. The clear language is if the employee worked less than 26 weeks, worked meaning what the dictionary word work means, and you divide by the total number of weeks actually worked. It's not these statutory provisions are not individual provisions. The language of the statute, the provided that, the comma, the semicolons, they have to be read in its totality. And we submit whether or not it's ambiguous or unambiguous that the claimant's position makes the most sense in reaching the General Assembly's intent.
The trial judge's, doctrinal justification for taking the interpretive approach that he did was that to do it your way would result in a windfall. Obviously, your response is no, it will not result in a windfall. My question is, what follows from the because after the word windfall?
The earning capacity of the claimant is what governs here. The average weekly wage, and I'll just use this case as the example because I think it best illustrates my point. Her earning capacity was between $500 and $1,100. If you use my interpretation, the claimant's interpretation, the average weekly wage is $788, which just so happens to fall right in the middle of those two. She's not going to be based her earnings on $788 per week, which is $20,000. It's going to be two-thirds of that amount. Two-thirds of that amount is $13,000 and some change. There's no windfall because she earned $12,000 in the 6 months before she was hurt. Under our interpretation, she'll make $13,000 when you pay her for 6 months of time. Those numbers are pretty equivalent. I think it's somewhat misleading, unintentionally so, in the below briefs and order, that she actually gets $20,000 for that same period, and it shows this windfall of $8,000. There is no windfall. It's pretty equivalent to
$1,000.
Correct. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Frank Nardo. I represent the appellant, Diamond State Port, with regard to this matter. It is our position that the decision of the Industrial Accident Board is supported by substantial evidence and free from legal error. We believe it is further supported by the Superior Court decision affirming the Industrial Accident Board.
Do you agree that this is a case of first impression and it's important to the profession to resolve the issue?
I do.
So we're not really talking about substantial evidence. We're talking about a matter of law, statutory construction, aren't we?
Yes. If there is an ambiguity in the statute, which Your Honor may find that there is, or Your Honors may find that it is not, it is our position that the provision of the statute that applies to the case at bar is 2302B, and that section does not have ambiguity contained in it. In fact, if I may, it states the average weekly wage shall be determined by computing the total wages paid to the employee during the 26 weeks immediately preceding the date of injury and dividing by 26. It doesn't use the word worked. I think that's where we run into some ambiguity possibly with 2302B1. But in 2302B, it specifically says you total the wages for the 26 weeks immediately preceding the injury and divide by 26. It does not say to do such as the appellant states, to take the 26 weeks of earnings and divide by, in this case, they would have you divide by 16. In fact, there is a windfall. If you look at the average weekly wage as calculated by the employer and supported by the decisions of $485 a week, and if you multiply that by 26 weeks, it comes out to what this claimant's actual earnings were, $12,610. That's tax-free dollars that she made. She would have gotten less, she would have gotten two-thirds of that from workers' compensation, but that's tax-free money. That's the difference.
Well, help me understand what B1 means when it says after the provided that colon, which sounds like a qualification to the first language in B. One says if the employee worked less than 26 weeks, but at least 13 weeks, the average weekly wage is based upon the total number of weeks actually worked. What's the significance of those words?
Well, I think if you look at the entire section with the subsections in total, it becomes clear as to what the legislature is trying to do here. In 23,
help me there because it's not clear to me.
Well, if Your Honor would look at 2302B, it appears clear that is for long-term employees, at least longer than 26 weeks or 26 weeks or longer, and that section deals with those employees that have been employed for more than 26 weeks or at least 26 weeks. 2302B1 is for employees that have not worked 26 weeks but have worked more than 13 weeks in the employment for which with the same employer. 2302B2 goes a further notch down, where, again, it doesn't use the word worked in this section. It says if the employee sustains a compensable injury before completing that employee's first 13 weeks. So you have a situation where you have one provision for employees that work 26 weeks or more, one provision for employees that work 13 to 26 weeks, and one provision for employees that have not completed the first 13 weeks of work with that employer. And that's the way it's broken down, actually fairly efficiently there.
But where does this appellant fall?
The appellant is clearly, she is a 12-year-plus employee of the port. She clearly worked more than 26 weeks with this employer. In fact, over a decade, she worked for this employer. So 2302B is what applies to her. We don't get to B1 or B2 because she wasn't an employee that's been with the employer less than 26 weeks or less than 13 weeks to move down to B, subsection B2.
It doesn't say be with the employer less than 26 weeks. It says worked less than 26 weeks. And then it goes on to talk with language that says actually worked. What's the significance of that?
The first use of the word work, it is our position that it's synonymous to employed. If the rest of that sentence is read, if the employee worked less than 26 weeks but at least 13 in the employment in which the employee was injured. So with that employer, you're working, you're an employee of that. The actual number of weeks worked becomes the number you use as a divisor to that. That is, again, for a situation if the employee worked less than 26 weeks but more than 13, you would go back and say, okay, I've been here for 18 weeks. What are my wages for the 18 weeks and divided by the actual number of work weeks, which would be 18, to get the proper and reasonable calculation.
Do you agree, as your colleague told us, that the ultimate objective is to determine and pay comp based on earning capacity?
I do, and I think this case and in the decisions below supports the calculation that was given in this case, $485 a week. Because if you look at her earning capacity, part of that is, I believe, you'd have to look at her actual earnings. In this case, with the Port of Wilmington, or Diamond State Port, more accurately, this is not a situation where the employee works each and every week. Her earning capacity with this employer is not $580 to $1,100 because she made those on some weeks. This is not a constant or consistent weekly earning facility. The employees are called in when a boat comes in and needs to be offloaded, when there is product that needs to be moved. And not all employees are brought in every other week or every third week. It just depends on where you are in the pecking order, what number you are, and what work they have for you that particular day. If you look at her calculation here, again, if you calculated out what she actually made the 6 months prior to this, $12,610, that is exactly 1/26th. Or 1/26 of that is the average weekly wage that we propose the court adopt. If we were to use the $788.12 cent per week average weekly wage for the claimant, the 26 weeks would be $20,491.12, an almost 40% windfall for this claimant. And that is a true windfall. That is, their comp rate would be 2/3 of 788. But that's tax-free money. We're talking about gross numbers. Average weekly wage, $788.12, would equate to her gross earnings of $20,491.12, which is 40% higher than what she actually earned during that period of time.
Well, is it your position then that earning capacity means, given this kind of sporadic employment situation, what you actually are capable of earning when you're called to work, or what you're actually capable of earning during a period of time when you're both called to work and subject to call to work?
I believe it would have to be based on with your earning capacity with this employer is what you've actually been able to make and based on the job availability. It's a different scenario, I think, if...
So the answer to my question is earning capacity as you interpret it, as you believe the legislature wants us to interpret it, is both the amount you're paid when you're actually working, taking into consideration the period of time you're employed but not called to work and therefore not earning anything. Those two time periods are combined to determine earning capacity.
I think that is correct in this case, to calculate an average weekly wage using the earning capacity. I mean, what we're looking for are averages.
Do you agree that the scheme of the comp statute as a whole let me restate that. Do you believe that we've been instructed by the legislature when interpreting the workers' comp scheme in Delaware to liberally construe it in favor of the compensating the employee?
I would agree that that is generally what the courts are instructed to do.
As between your interpretation and your colleague's interpretation, which is the more liberal?
The more liberal and the more reasonable would be my employer's interpretation. It's the only one that works with the statute. It is the only reasonable interpretation of what the legislature gave us.
You would equate liberally construed with reasonably construed to compensate the employee? Or do you construe
correctly? Construed might be a better.
Well, would you construe liberal to mean that in the event the language of our statute is ambiguous, our instruction to you, the courts, are to interpret it in light of the ambiguity in favor of the employee? Is that what the phrase liberally construed to compensate the employee means?
But not without limit. If there's an ambiguity, then we can go to as far left, if you will, as the claimant, for instance, in this case, would have you go.
Let's use liberal in a flexibility and not political sense.
And the flexibility, I would agree, has to be within the workings of the statute and what the intent of the statute is. And I would agree that it is to be liberally construed if there's ambiguity. I think that's a well-established standard. But I also believe that the position that the employer is taking here is the only position, if you liberally construe this language, that works within the statute. I mean, without going totally outside the statute and making it nonsensical.
You're basically saying there's no ambiguity. The statute says what it means, and we have only one way of interpreting it.
I believe that is true in this case because I do not believe that we get beyond 2302B, which is adding the total wages for 26 weeks, dividing by 26 weeks. In this case, we have that. It is very clear if you look at the statute as a whole that it is specifically designed to make sure that someone without a work history, that you can accurately make a calculation of the average weekly wage. In this case, again, if we look at it in a vacuum, Section B1, subsection B1 seems like it has an ambiguity. But if you look at it...
Is your argument dependent on this court construing the word worked to mean employed?
In a common sense, a common meaning of that word. I work for Tibout Redfern and Powell. On Sunday, hopefully, I won't be in the office, but I still work for Tibout Redfern and Powell. So to that extent, we think work is synonymous with employed by.
It's colloquial.
Correct.
Let me ask you a factual question. Under your side's interpretation of the statute, the number that Ms. Taylor comes out with is about $485 a week, is that right?
Our number is $485. Theirs is $788.12.
That's under their method of calculation and a different interpretation.
Correct.
Would each of those numbers be non-taxable? That is, are they tax affected?
They are not. You get two-thirds of that average weekly wage. My understanding is if it's $485, you get two-thirds of that, and you're not paying taxes on it. That's why you're getting two-thirds of it. Same with her gross earnings of $12,610 that she made during that 26 weeks are gross numbers that she would have to pay taxes on that earning from working for the port.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand how all that factors in. I think you said that if you take into account the tax effect of the number that your side is advocating for, or the interpretation your side is advocating for, then that figure comes very close to being the actual total wages for 26 weeks?
For 26 weeks, but I think possibly there's a misunderstanding in that I don't think the tax ramifications, if we talk purely in gross numbers, her gross earnings were $12,610 for 26 weeks. That's independent, obviously, of taxes. She got two-thirds of that, a little over $8,200. The average weekly wage that we calculated on that is $485 if multiplied by 26 weeks, comes out to her gross number of $12,610. The comp rate would roughly be two-thirds of $485.
You've lost me.
Okay.
If you take $485 and multiply it by 26, do you get $12,000?
Correct. That's her gross number, and that's her gross average weekly wage.
That's
correct.
How the numbers work out.
Correct. And but she would get paid.
Okay.
I don't want to interrupt
you. That's irrespective.
Okay.
That's not taking into account taxes at all.
Not from earnings or from workers' comp.
Okay, and would the same be true for the $788 number that Ms. Taylor is advocating for?
Well, what would be true there is the gross amount that she would have earned over that 26-week period is $20,491 rather than $12,610.
Okay.
That's the windfall of nearly 40%.
You say that's a windfall. Mr. Dvorkian says there is no windfall because the actual economic benefit, I guess post-tax, is $13,000. Is that right? Which comes out pretty much, you know, to the same total as yours.
Maybe if you're then would be comparing her gross numbers of $12,000 and saying she would net $13,000 without, you know, after taxes. So that's the difference is.
But under yours, you would net $8,000 plus, right?
Just as she actually did working 26 weeks and earning $12,610. If you have a gross amount, what she netted.
Okay.
Again, we're using two-thirds tax number.
Okay. If you don't take into account, if you don't net out the taxes, then you're comparing $13,000 and $20,000.
I'm not sure I understand what taxes have to do with any of this. Workers' comp is based on two-thirds of wages.
Correct.
What's the tax element here?
I don't think there is a tax element. I don't think that applies it only to the argument that the two numbers are there's no windfall, and I think there's obviously a windfall because the gross numbers that you look at under our scenario and our average weekly wage calculation comes to exactly what her gross earnings were for 26 weeks, as opposed to using their numbers would indicate that she had worked 26 weeks and earned in excess of $20,000 during that period of time, which is a windfall to the claimant because she did not work that amount of time and would not have earned that amount with the port, because the port is not a constant weekly employer where it's you got 40 hours a week every week. It is you're called in, sometimes you make $580, sometimes you might make $1,000, then you don't work for a couple of weeks, and then you come in and you might work a shift and make something less and something more. Looking at the statute, the only interpretation is to use those numbers as they actually are. I mean, it tells you exactly to total the wages divide by 26.
When you say as they actually are, you mean pre-tax?
Pre-tax. Pre-tax, if then you would be talking about not the person's average weekly wage, but the person's workers' compensation rate, which is two-thirds of the average weekly wage, if you want to compare apples to apples.
Thank you very much, Mr. Narda.
Very good. Thank you.
I don't wish to further complicate this than it already is with these calculations. Let me just... hopefully this will address your question. If you accept $485 as the average weekly wage, which is the employer's interpretation, she gets two-thirds of that, which would be roughly $7,000, $6,000. I was trying to do some quick math. If you accept our interpretation, she would get two-thirds of $788, which would be roughly $13,000.
And that's because that's what workers' comp pays. It has nothing to do with state and federal taxes.
Absolutely correct. I don't want this to get lost. It is earning capacity, not loss of income. And focusing kind of on those numbers, it's kind of like you're looking at loss of income. It's future earning capacity. If Ms. Taylor can earn between $500 and $1,100 per week, that is her earning capacity. If she were to go out the next day and get a job someplace else, she's not capable of earning $488. She's capable of earning somewhere between $500 and $1,100.
Now, Mr. Narda, if he got a chance to speak again, might argue, probably far more articulately than I'm going to put this, he might argue that what your earning capacity also includes the period of time she's not called to work but makes herself available for work.
Let me address.
So you can't just focus on when she actually works. That's because she falls within B, because she's been paid wages for more than 26 weeks or for 26 weeks before the incident. So everything's included in what she could actually earn.
But the statute doesn't stop with a period at B. It's provided that and the words actually worked, not what were you capable of working if there was employment available to you. But let me also say this.
Let's explore your actually work for a minute. Mm-hmm. You may be absolutely right, and we'll find that out later. I'll find it out later from my colleagues. But it says actually worked in that employment. Does that mean in that capacity with that employer, or does in that employment mean with that employer in whatever capacity?
Well, I believe it means actually worked for that in that employment for that employer. It's not going to be if you went out and went and got a job someplace
else.
That's
a term of art that you who practice in that area
right.
would understand.
It's worked, you would never take in.
I who never did always have trouble with your terms of art.
I want to address the sporadic earnings and whether or not, in this case, Ms. Taylor was out of work for 10 weeks. And I don't want to make it just to this case because this case is going to have broad implications. In this case, we stipulated below, if you look at the trial transcript from the IAB, that the reason she missed the time from work was for unemployment, unrelated health issues. It wasn't because there wasn't work available. But I would submit to you, it makes no difference whether you're out of work for the fact that there's work not available to you or whether or not you're out of work for unrelated health reasons or because you've got a sick parent. You still have to focus on the earning capacity. And for someone who's been with an employer for 20 years making $500 per week that may only work 15 weeks before a work accident, their earning capacity is not half of what it's been for the last 20 years. It is going to be what they were capable of earning, and that's why you have to divide by the number that they were physically there earning a wage, not zero earnings.
So you ignore the down periods?
You're ignoring the down periods because the statute tells you that's what you're supposed to do if you accept our interpretation of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have one question or comment to make to all of you. It's a little bit inside baseball, and it's no warning to my colleagues either, but
it'll help us move this forward. I think all of us are conscious that this has implications for the future. The mere fact you mentioned it may affect other appeals causes our ears to perk up. You see a three-justice panel. You don't see an en banc court. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, it's like the forward pass. Three things can happen. We unanimously decide it one way or another. It leaves it open, arguably, for other people to come back and say, but the en banc court hasn't decided it. So it doesn't discourage any appeals. Let's assume it's obvious that if we were to divide, it's going to go en banc because we can't get three votes for either position. If we were to conclude this is something that we can discuss with our colleagues after they read the briefs and not have further oral argument, would you find that troublesome? Would you, if we split, and we never ask people this, and we never discuss the case ahead of time, so I have no idea what's going to happen. That's part of the inside baseball of our culture. Nobody knows what anyone else on this bench thinks about these issues. Would you want further oral argument? That's the question.
I think further argument would be appropriate because there are so many nuances, and this is going to have implications. I want to make sure everybody understands.
I know it's expensive for your clients. It arguably delays a result because we've got to get everybody's schedule in tune. But, Mr. Nardo, what's your position on that?
I would agree with Ms. Seville as well, although I'm not sure that, I mean, the issue is really that word worked.
I'm not asking for
argue about it.
Yeah, I'm not asking for re-argument on how simple the issue is or how clear you are and how clear the statute is. I'm just saying if, in the event, we split and it goes on bonk, do you think it's important enough that we have another oral argument? That's all I want to know. You say yes?
I
would agree. All right, we'll obviously take that into consideration. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Advisement.